The following podcast is part of a special oral history program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. The program documents fascinating and personal stories and experiences of veterans across South Australia. The program received funding through the Veteran and Community Grants stream in partnership with the Tanunda RSL sub-branch and the Emu Tree, and was produced by Christian Teusner. I encourage listeners to take their time to explore as many of these stories and adventures as possible. For further information, visit www.theemutree.com. Today is the 28th of July.
Yeah.
I'm in Pandana on Kangaroo Island at the home of Des Johnston. Des, thank you very much for agreeing to chat with me today. Can I get you to state your full name, please?
Desmond Keith Johnston.
And your date of birth, please?
17th of December 1925.
And your service number as well, please?
PA 4598. I think a lot of people would be surprised today. I was born north of Peterborough in the pastoral country. We had to either walk or ride a horse 3 miles to school every day. And I went to school until I was grade 7 down my QC. And then because I was only 12 when I got my QC and I had nowhere else to go to school, nowhere further to go to school, my mother sent me back to this Dawson school for another 12 months. So I went back to school for another 12 months and done the grade 7 again. And I left school when I was 13 and I headed from Peterborough to Port Augusta and went out working on an outstation when I was 13. And I lived with a black fella on an outstation, and he was an exceptional old fella. He really was a nice, tidy old chap. And I stayed there until I enlisted when I was 17.
Could you maybe describe a little bit about that period? Like, you know, what were you doing? A daily kind of routine?
Yeah, it was just a matter of on the outstation of patrolling the fences and making sure that they were kept in stock-proof condition and that the sheep were always tidy, like it, to make sure that any of them that were struck were dressed, were treated, and that was about all we done in all that time. Yeah.
So what would you do to keep yourself entertained?
There was nothing really, nothing. We used to shower with a hose hanging over the doorstep with cold water. You know, just imagine the kids today doing that.
They good memories for you, that period?
I don't regret any of it, no. No point in regretting it, is there?
You mentioned there that you enlisted at the age of 17. What was your motivation or your reasons for choosing that kind of direction at that point?
To enlist then?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I suppose it was just one of those things where we sort of knew what the Japs were about to do. I'd seen them meet them in their territory than meet them for them to meet me in my territory. So I think that was everybody's attitude, was to go and meet them up in the islands, not let them come down and meet us here. 1943, yeah.
How did you feel? Was it exciting? Were you anxious?
No, I just never ever worried about it. Just took it as it come. Same as everybody did, yeah.
Whereabouts did you do all your training?
In the services?
Mm.
Yeah, down in Melbourne, down in the training there. Well, we only trained for 2 months. When I was drafted to the Swan, I went to Sydney and went on an English destroyer to Port Moresby, and then caught up with the Swan up there.
What were some of your duties?
All the time I was on the Swan, I was on the helm. So I was a watchkeeper. Yeah. There was nearly 200 on board, yeah. So there was plenty of people on board the Swan there. Yeah. There was very little to do apart from action stations. when there was action stations, of course, yeah, there was double the number required. That's why there was always so many on board. When I left home, my mother gave me a little brownie camera, and like it was illegal, you weren't supposed to ever carry a camera. But I did, and I seemed to always, I always got away with it. And I took a tremendous lot of photos during the activities. The only trouble was when you run out of film, that was the end of it, because you couldn't buy any more. You had to wait until you come all the way down south to get any more film. The amazing thing about all of the war to me was those people were on New Island, and they were obviously they were running a mission, and when the Japanese took over, of course, they were taken as prisoners, and I'm not going to tell you what they would have done to those girls. I remember when we went in to pick them up on the beach, there was a fuzzy wuzzy there, and the Japs had cut the sinews in the backs of his legs, and he had big calluses on his hands and body on his knees where that's all he could do was crawl. And I had to carry one of those nuns out to the boat. Now, on the way out, I said to her, "You're going to get some pretty rough handling from here on," because I said, "I've got to somehow poke up over the gunwale, which is about, 3-4 feet above the water." And she said to me, "I don't care what you do to me as long as you get me out of here." We took them back on board and took them back to Port Moresby and left them there. I don't know what happened to them after that. I would have loved to have known what happened to them afterwards. I know the poor old priest. There was five nuns and a priest, and he died before he got home, before they got back to Germany, apparently. It's strange, isn't it, the fact that we were fighting the Germans and they were out here looking after people in missions and taken prisoners by the Japanese. Strange world, wasn't it? One night we were in convoy. These are the parts that I like to talk about. We were behind, I think, come bringing up the stern. No, we were out in the lead. The last ship in the convoy radioed us to tell us they heard voices in the water. So the skipper turned around and went. We turned around and went back to approximately where we thought it should have been, and switched one of the signal lamps on, and picked up these two Japs in a little canoe. And obviously, what had happened, they must have gone out fishing or something, and must have drifted out to sea, and got that far out, they got lost. And as they got close to the ship, the skipper used to take off because he wouldn't let them touch the ship in case they had explosives on board the canoe and the little dinghy. And they'd paddle ahead to try and get on up to close to us again, and he'd take off again. And he was trying to tell them to he'd throw them a rope, and they had to grab the rope and come on board. And they pulled them on board, and once we got them on board, we couldn't get rid of them. We were told they were our prisoners, so we had to keep them. And that's what we made them do. They made them do all our washing. So they were pretty lucky. They were fed and bloody everything else and bloody. But they had to do our washing, all the ship's company washing. Like, you had to sort of try and signal to them. But the only way you could make them understand was to put the tub of water in front of them and give them the clothes and point, "Here, get into it." So they were pretty handy. They were our washing machine. They were locked up of a night time in the flag locker, yeah. They must have got a surprise to think that we were so good to them. I guess they would have thought that we would have treated them like they treated us. But of course that wasn't the Australian attitude, was it? But they were on board for 3 months before we could get rid of them. Everywhere we went, and over they said, "Yeah, they're your prisoners, you keep them."
I wonder what happened to them.
I don't know what happened to them in the end. We dropped them at Port Moresby. Yeah. That was at the end of the war. That's the surrender, the Japanese surrender of New Holland. That's the old boat. Look at what a wreck that is. See, when MacArthur came back from the Middle East and took over the Southwest Pacific, his attitude was, there's no point in us going to fight them because they're dug in. The best way to handle it is to cut off their supplies. And that's what he did. So they finished up, they had no medical, they had no ammunition, they had no fuel, they had nothing. And like, and then of course the atomic bomb, that did finish it. But you can see what a wreck the old Leningrad was there. And they come in, there's the hand over the sword there.
Whereabouts were these photographs taken?
That was in New Ireland, yeah.
Could I get you to talk a little bit about what happened to you then when the war was over, and where did you move to? And
when we came home, it was a bit hard to settle down to go back to work for a while, but everybody did. Everybody went. I went messing around doing, running Brumbies for a while, and breaking horses in, and doing whatever you could do until I went back to work for Elders for a little while, and then finished up coming over here to Kangaroo Island.
So, working for Elders, whereabouts was that?
Down the south edge, down at Millicent.
That's where you met Rita.
That's right.
Yeah. Would you like to share that? How did you meet?
Oh no, she, I just struck her mainly around sport and that. Yeah. In the end of 1946, 47.
And what year did you get married then?
1948. Yeah, like I said, I met her around sport where she was playing sport. But that's been something of my life, I suppose, is sport. I've got 6 life memberships,
yeah.
4 for football, and 1 for bowls, and 1 for the community club up here.
And who are the life memberships with?
A life membership with the Pandana Football Club. A life membership with the Kangaroo Island Football League. I've got a merit award with the South Australian National Football League. And I've got an Australian sports medal for my contribution to football. I took on the job of building the bowling green up here, and I did that with the majority of the work I'd done with all my my own trucks and that. And I got a life membership for that, of course.
Playing football?
Yeah.
What was your main positions?
I did a bit of ruck work. I didn't play as much football as I would have liked to have, because when I went to school, of course, there was only about 12 kids went to school, so there wasn't enough to play football. There was only 6 fellas and 6 boys and 6 girls. So I never ever got any football until the war years. And then when I left school, as I told you, I went away up and lived on an outstation, so there was no football there either. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to play footy until I was till the war years, probably. Yeah, they've spoilt the football. They've really spoiled it. They've changed the rules too much and paid too much money. But that's ridiculous, the money that they're getting to play football. That's just not on. Yeah, well, yes, NFL is better football than the AFL. The AFL is just all, it's ridiculous. It's just all scramble. Like, and they'll toss the ball up and 4 times, 5 times in the one spot before the ball's cleared and all that. It's ridiculous. Fighting and scrapping and rolling around the ground and what they do playing football now. They've spoiled it. It's not what it used to be.
So was there any football in your naval days? Was there any recreational football on any occasions?
Well, strangely enough, now and again we'd finish up in the same place as a different ship, and we'd challenge them. Most of the time it was rugby. And can you imagine me playing rugby? I never had the faintest idea of the rules or anything. but we did play it.
Must have been a great sense of normality in doing that.
Oh, yeah, there was, yeah. Yeah, we got a lot of enjoyment out of it. Met a lot of friends, yeah. You could imagine what sort of a game it was when half of them were by Australian rules and the other half were playing rugby players.
Could I get you, Des, to talk a little bit about your move to Kangaroo Island and when that was and what that was like and, you know, your first impressions of Kangaroo Island?
I never had a great deal of luck on farming on Kangaroo Island. I came over, as you can imagine, when the farms were originally allocated, it was pretty tough. Like there was very little way of making any money because you couldn't run to any number of sheep. I'd done a lot of contract work, and that was how I managed to survive. But a lot of people didn't even survive. When I would say a lot of people, the majority of them didn't survive. And I did a lot of contract work, and, you know, believe it, I'd be out in the paddock of a morning contracting with a tractor. I'd be in the paddock before daylight, waiting for it to come daylight at 5 o'clock to start work. I wouldn't see my kids for a month at times, because when I got home at 9 o'clock they were in bed, and it was Rita that looked after the kids and brought them up, and also looked after what had to be done on the farm while I was out contracting. So things weren't that easy.
Some hard graft.
Mm.
What year did you move to Kangaroo Island?
I came over in 1950.
It was 70 years since
I got here. Island. So I'm just about a Kangaroo Islander now.
Could you elaborate a little bit more maybe on your first impressions of Kangaroo Island?
My first impressions?
Hmm.
Yeah, well, I always had a lot of faith in the island, mainly because of rainfall. If you got rainfall, as long as you got plenty of rain, well, it's amazing what you can do with country. And if it's not good enough, as this wasn't, and they found the trace elements that it needed to produce, and which it did. And then as I said earlier, in 1960, of course, I was burnt out, and that set us back again. In 1970, I bought the second farm, and 1972, I was burnt out there. Then in 1978, we bought our third farm.
You know, does it rekindle all those memories, having the recent fires here on Kangaroo Island?
Yeah, like the island was always excellent country. I had it producing 4 or 5 sheep to the acre, which is pretty good. That would even up anywhere with country anywhere, just about. So like, there's certainly nothing wrong with the island. But my final blow was in 1980. I got foot rot. People on Kangaroo Island in those days knew nothing about foot rot. And the people that were in charge of it done everything wrong. They set about trimming the hooves. And a lot of guys got together and came out and helped each other do the trimming. And they came out, and this guy that was in charge of it, I won't mention names, he told them how to trim the feet on them. And I took 1,500 wieners back to the paddock that night. I got up the next morning and went down, and they were all scattered over the paddock. Not one of them could walk. So I set about trying to water them and give them oats to keep them alive. But I couldn't, it didn't work. They all died on me. Died on the spot. Then I sort of got over that and recovered and bred again. I was eventually cleared of foot rot. Took me 5 years, and 5 years, six times trimming the feet. And that's a lot of feet when you've got 10,000 sheep to trim. And finally, like I said, I was cleared. And 12 months after I was cleared, I went around the sheep one day and I struck a young ewe limping, so I chased her on the motorbike and caught her. She had foot rot again. I don't know where the foot rot came from, because I never ever bought any sheep. But the only sheep I bought was rams. But I got it. And when I caught that sheep after I'd been cleared and found it had foot rot, I got the pocket knife out and cut its throat. Then I sat on the motorbike and I thought to myself, now what the hell am I doing breeding sheep and cutting their throat with a pocket knife? So I went home and walked in the door and said to Rita, start packing. I'm finished. 5 years sitting down trimming sheep feet, And then still finding that you still had foot rot was too much for me, so I gave farming away.
Wow.
So that was the end of my farming.
That must have been pretty tough.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, especially when I'd never ever bought any sheep or anything. So like, how come I got foot rot on two farms? And the guy that was in charge of it, obviously, he hadn't. Nowadays they do it and they get rid of it in 6 months. Yeah, but obviously the guy just wasn't up to it, and they were two. The lads that trimmed the feet wasn't their fault. I never ever blamed them for it. They did it too erratically, you know. They just cut too much off and they poor buggers couldn't walk. One of the farms I bloody got guys to come and load them up. I loaded them up on a truck and sent them to Adelaide. I sold 3,500 sheep. I got a cheque for $900. My son bought a caravan park and a motel in Cooktown, so we went up to Cooktown and lived up there for 3.5 years. Yeah. Then I came, after they sold that up there, I came back down here, built the house, and here I am.
What year did you build this house?
I built it 30 years ago, so that'd be 1990, like after I sold the farms because of the foot rot, built the house next door. And all the people that knew me used to go past saying, "Hey, you'll never finish it." But I did. It took me 12 months to build it, but I finished it.
Being in Pandana for so many years, I mean, you must absolutely know everybody.
Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, there wasn't anybody here that I didn't know. There are a lot of people here today, though, that I don't know. Farms have changed in hands, you know, reasonably regular compared to what they used to. So there's quite a lot of people who I don't know, but there is a lot that I do know. Yeah.
What would you say are the biggest changes here in Pandana over that time?
Over that time? Yeah, I suppose, like when the farms were originally set up, they were set up at 800 acres with roughly 400 acres of scrub. The same as after the First World War. The soldier settlement. There was a lot of soldier settlement done after the First World War, and the country they gave them wasn't enough. It wasn't big enough for people to make a living. And the same thing happened there on the island. Like 800 acres, I cleared the other 400 acres on mine straight away, but it still wasn't enough land. Like 400 acres wasn't enough. And nowadays, the big change that's happened since then is nearly everybody today owns two farms, or maybe three or four farms. So that means, like, as you can imagine, I went to a ram sale here. I've kept an interest in the sales, and I went to a ram sale here just recently, and when I walked in the wool shed to the sale, I thought, goodness me, this fella's not going to have a very good sale because there's not many here. Not many people here. And then all of a sudden I thought, well, the reason that there's not many people here now, everybody that's here owns three or four farms. So like there's only a third or only a quarter of the people here to buy now, but they're still buying the same number of rams. So I guess that's been the big change on the island. It was a bit tough on the ones that came here. They had a, you know, just wasn't enough land, and it wasn't developed enough for them to make a living or anything, and yet they, you know, they had to survive. And like I said to you earlier, there was very few of the 180 odd that were settled here on the island. There was very, very few of them that survived. You don't like the ones that I would consider that survived and made a success of it wouldn't be any more than 20. All of the rest of them, you know, a lot of them left 3 or 4 years after they were allocated the farms. And some of them survived longer than that, but to turn around and say the successful ones, there wouldn't have been any more than 20 or 30 that were successful enough to stay. And that happened after the First World War too. Like they allocated country in the pastoral, areas, and it just run the 100 square mile. My uncle was allocated a 100 square mile block of land out from Port Augusta. He survived, but you know, it just wasn't enough land. And exactly the same thing happened after the Second World War here.
How underdeveloped was Kangaroo Island when you moved to Kangaroo Island?
Oh, goodness me, when I came here from the bottom of the Carnarvon this way, it was all scrub. There was nothing here. It was just a few gum tracks through the scrub. Yeah, there was nothing. Yeah. It was amazing, though, the number of people that were out here. I always admired the people, how they survived. I don't know that there would have been people. I've written a little article on them, the ones that were here before we came here, that were out in this country. And they were tremendous people, and they survived in it. But a lot of them had more land than what we did, of course.
And back in 1950, was there many people from the mainland coming over to Kangaroo Island to explore Kangaroo Island?
Right, like as tourists?
Yeah, did a lot of people visit Kangaroo Island back in those times?
Not a lot. There was few people used to come into American River and stay there, but there wasn't a lot of tourists, no. Nothing like it is at the moment. I suppose you can't blame people for coming to the island, can you? Like, it's certainly, you know, there's some scenery on the island around the coast. I can tell you what the coast's like because I've ridden a horse from D'Estrey Bay to Cape Border around the coast, and the rest of the island, what I haven't by boat, I've gone by aeroplane. So I've been all the way around the coast of the island.
So what was your experience on horseback from D'Estrey Bay around to Cape Border? Could you describe that experience?
Yeah, like we didn't do it in one hit, of course. We'd done it in several, like probably 8 or 10 weekends. That we used to head down to where the nearest place we could get with the horse floats and get on the horses and head off, and then people would meet us further on. But it was always pretty easy to ride horses along the coast because there was always the wallaby kangaroo tracks and that you could follow. I did a lot of the 3 years I worked for the Lands Department, I was on dozer, which meant that most of the time I was pulling scrub. And that particular time, Bert Oldfield, who was the supervisor, he got me to go down and put these plots in. I had to tow a Majestic behind me, and I had a dozer track in, and I'd have to drop the Majestic and doze ahead and then come back and pick the Majestic up and then go on again. And that was when I struck this lagoon, and I couldn't believe it when I struck it, somebody had been there and dug this drain. It was about 7 or 8 feet deep and about 300 metres and just wide enough to stand in. And they dug the drain and drained the lagoon. And then that sort of got me thinking, why would anybody do that? And that's why I've always been interested to find out what I could about it. And as I said, that's what I found out eventually, that somebody by the name of Burgess went in there and grown potatoes. And like, fancy taking that on. And it was 70 years ago when I found it. So it would have been 30 years before that when the drain was dug. So it would have been 100 years ago when somebody went in there growing potatoes. And I can always remember when I seen it, just on the edge of where I'd stayed, there was a lot of heaps of dirt, like ranges of dirt, and I didn't take any notice of it at the time. I just thought wild pigs had been digging it up. But then when somebody had said that they were growing potatoes, that suddenly hit me that what I seen was where they'd ridged it up to grow the potatoes. So it all came together that it was a Burgess that done it, because the original name of the lagoon was Burgess Lagoon on the old map, And then when I found out it was growing potatoes, somebody suggested that that's what they were doing, I realised that was right, because that's what the ridges would have been. It's so amazing to think that somebody went down there growing potatoes way out there in the middle of the scrub 100 years ago.
And whereabouts on the island is this?
Is it? It's not that far from the Western Districts Oval. It'd only be a mile from the Western Districts Oval. And the drain comes right back out. The end of the drain is almost on the new road, like the highway down to Cape Border.
So working for the Lands Department, it must have been quite amazing exploring and digging, you know, clearing and digging these tracks in really unspoilt
Kangaroo
Island native land.
Yeah, it was really like you never ever knew what was going to turn up next. Like when we shifted once, it got too wet in the middle of the island in the winter time for the logging. We're just getting bogged too much, so they decided to shift us over to the north coast, where it was steeper country over there, and there would be better upright. And we headed off, four dozers headed off to go from the middle of the island here across to the north coast. And we run into the Signet River, and it was too much water in it to cross it, so we had to keep going up the river until we could find where we could finally get across it. Finally, it got dark on us. We were sort of virtually lost because we couldn't go in the direction we wanted to go. And I'll never forget this. We barely pulled up on the top of a hill with the four dozers, and we could see this light. So we left three of the dozers there, and all four of us climbed on one tractor and headed for the light. And we run into this old fellow that was out, George Johncock, his name was, and he lived out in the scrub. The next morning we came back to get the dozers, and we found that when we headed off to go headed to the light, we went over the top of all his fences and everything. So we had to repair all his fences, and he had about 200 acres cleared there where he was. And the next morning I said to him, God, how did you manage to clear this? And he said to me, what the old forts in there couldn't pull down, I cut down with the axe. Incredible. Fancy somebody going out there to clear the country with an axe. That'll give you a bit of an idea of what some of these people were like that were here before we got here. They went out and cleared that fancy coming here and going out into the middle of the scrub and clearing country like that. Old Vic Wallace was out here. He was my neighbour. And he was Cook and Wallace, you know, the caterers in Adelaide. He was one of that family. He built a little house out there and cleared that country. And in the wintertime, he was locked in there. When the rivers come down, that was it. He couldn't move. He couldn't get a kingscote or anything for 3 or 4 months. Mm. So they are the people that like, you've got to admire when coming to this country. Goodness me. One thing that was quite strange, I couldn't believe it, and I suppose they're still there, but when we cleared this country, and when it was originally, it was amazing the number of shiny stones, like wash stones that had obviously been on the coastline, been in the water. You know how you see the round stones? They were scattered all over the island. How the hell did they get there? I was never able to work out how they got up here on the plateau, like on the centre of the island. Some of them were broken, a lot of them were broken, but a lot of them were still whole, like the round stone that you'd pick up on the coastline, where it had been continually washed. How did they get up here? They were just ordinary, what you'd see, beach stones. Yeah. How the hell did they get up there? They wouldn't have been round up here, they wouldn't have been washed up here. But how did they get up here? And there was a lot of them, not as though there was a dozen, but there would have been hundreds of them. And they're obviously still scattered around the island. And like, I can't imagine the Aborigines or natives of any description living in the scrub. How would people live in the scrub? You couldn't.
If you could sum up Kangaroo Island in just one or two sentences to someone who's never been here before, what would you say?
I could just about say that I reckon Kangaroo Island, given that it was managed properly, would be definitely some of the best country in South Australia. What you could produce off of this island would be tremendous. Well, like I said earlier, it's as long as you've got the rainfall, it's surprising what you can do. But if you haven't got that rainfall, there's nothing you can do. And that's why I left the north to come to Kangaroo Island.
6 months ago, Kangaroo Island suffered the devastating bushfires. You were here in Pandana during and lived through that experience. Could you tell me a little bit of what that was like for you?
This fire just recently was so devastating. It was incredible. Like, back in those earlier fires, the stock were able to sort of move away. But this time, the fire was so devastating that it just destroyed the stock straight away. And that normally doesn't happen. Normally you can shift sheep or the stock will survive it. They'll manage to walk through the fire and without any damage, but this time the fire was it was tremendous. Yeah, she was, it wasn't a real good fire. I went back one of the things that amazed me, I went out, I wasn't supposed to. People was told not to go out there, but I did. I got up and went out the day after the fire and had a look, and I couldn't believe how the number of koalas that must have found the bare road and died in the middle of the road with the heat. They had enough brains to sort of sit in the bare road, but the heat still killed them. Yeah. Surprising, a number of them were on the middle of the road. How the hell they found the road, I don't know. I suppose there was a lot that died in the scrub too. Yeah, we're pretty lucky, really. I don't know. I think the people in Pandana owe the safety to the air bombers, the aeroplanes. They were the only ones that could have possibly put it out. They must have concentrated on it down here where, you know, we're just back down here where you would have seen where it came. They must have concentrated, they must have put a tremendous amount of water on and slowed it down. It's because there's only a little patch around Pandana here, it's the only place that didn't burn. So you got to put that down to thank the bloody air bombers, don't you? There were nothing there stopped it. It lit up down in the ravine on the morning and finished up at Stokes Bay that night, and then the next day it went back this way and burnt right down to Birchmore. It was only virtually burnt until it burnt a lot longer than that, but that was when it, you know, went that distance. Yeah, it wasn't good. You see, some of them, the young lad that I was with yesterday, he lost 7,000 sheep. That's a terrible blow, because where do you replace 7,000 sheep anywhere near what the quality of the sheep were that he had? Because you go to all of the sales on the mainland and all you're going to buy there is somebody else's culls. Nobody's selling their best sheep. The only sheep that people sell, they cull them through age or through the type of sheep. So the only sheep they're going to buy is culls. So they've just got to, now, like a lad like him, he's got to sit back and spend all those years breeding back up to where he was before. Yeah, so it's not good.
How long do you think it'll take Kangaroo Island to recover from?
Some people will recover almost straight away, but a lot of people will take 4 or 5 years to recover, I suppose, at least that much to even get back here. Yeah. It won't be easy for them. There's been tremendous help over here. It's been incredible. I went down the street here one day. I went down to the medical centre, actually. And when I was there, this guy came up and said to me, "How are you going?" And I said, "I'm all right." He said, "Here, take this." He had a great big box full of groceries. And I said, no, I don't want them. I wasn't affected. My house wasn't burnt. I've lost nothing. And he said, look, we've got so much of that stuff here. He followed me out to the bus and put the box of groceries in it. I said, I don't want them. He said, we've got that much here, we've got to get rid of it. That's incredible.
Take it.
That's how much stuff was contributed there. You know, I said to you earlier, half a dozen of us signed on to go with Bill Davis. He was the skipper of the Swan, and he wanted some of us to sign on to go minesweeping. I think that was one of the best things I ever did. when we signed on, the night time, we'd go into port everywhere, and if we went to a pub or something, we'd never have bought a beer. People would always buy you the beer when you bought it. Like the war was just over, so she was on.
So you did minesweeping right around Australia?
Yeah, around all of the coast. Yeah.
What was the process?
Yeah, like it was, they had you let a cable go with a PV, like the PV was the float, and then you'd let a paravane go, and paravanes were like a louver window, big steel louver window, and that'd pull the cable down there and pull the cable down, and firstly, if that was the ship, the cable came down at 10 feet under the surface of the water and then across out back like this and then up to the PV, and that just swept along. And the cables of the mines would slide along the cable to the back of it, and when it hit the back there was a cutter there that cut the cable. The mines floated.
Was there ever any mishaps?
Yeah, we pulled the cable in one night and there was a bloody mines tangled up in the bloody end of it. It didn't take very long to let the cable out. But the only way then you could get them, you had to stand off with rifle fire and keep firing until you hit one of the horns to explode the mine. Yeah.
Des Johnston, can I just say thank you so much for sharing some stories with me today.
Yeah, that's all right.
It's been fascinating and a privilege to meet with you today.
That's fine.
Thank you so much.
That's all right.
You have been listening to The RSL, A Time to Celebrate, 2020.